How about now? Okay. Thank you for that prayer. And thank you, Beth and team. Where are you? For that sensitive and skillful leadership this morning. Really blessed me. I felt like I didn't need to come up here and preach the sermon because it was so well done. But this morning we're going to continue our study of Paul's first letter to the church in Corinth. And I've been asked to speak on the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians, which is famously known as the love chapter. Over the years, I've had a kind of an uneasy relationship with the love chapter. I've used it to beat myself up quite a lot in the past because of my failures at loving. But in more recent years, as I've experienced more of the grace of God, I've realized that God invites us into his heart of love, and then he invites us to join him in the program of bringing love to the world. And so I've entitled my message, Invitation to Love. And there's a little insert in your bulletin that has the outline of the message, and if you like, you can follow along, or if you don't, that's fine too. So our passage is structured in three sections, this chapter. And so I'm going to read it. It's going to be on the screen so you can follow along. And the second section of that chapter, I'd like you to read along with me if you could. And then I'll continue and finish it. So let's begin. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have faith that can move mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and surrender my body to the flames, but have not love, I gain nothing. Together we read, love is patient, love is kind. It does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud. It is not rude, it is not self-seeking, it is not easily angered, it keeps no record of wrong. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails, but where there are prophecies, they will cease. Where there are tongues, they will be stilled. Where there is knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when perfection comes, the imperfect disappears. When I was a child, I talked like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. But when I became a man, I put childish ways behind me. Now we see but a poor reflection in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part. Then I shall know fully, even as I am known. And now these things remain, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. May the words of my mouth and the meditation of all our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. So, part one then. We're going to look at each of these parts in turn, spending more time on the first and second and then dipping briefly into the last part. The first part of this passage I subtitled The Ultimacy of Love. Paul lays out his thesis very bluntly, very starkly, that if spiritual gifts in the church are not offered in love, they are useless. So no matter how eloquent we are, no matter how much prophetic knowledge we have and wisdom, no matter how much money we give away, it's useless without love. So I can't really improve on that, and I'm actually going to just leave that content for now. I'm going to use that first passage to put it, the whole chapter, in context with the letter that Paul wrote to the Corinthian church. The discussion of the gifts here at the beginning links us in with the rest of the letter. Often we hear the love chapter out of context. It's a literary masterpiece, and probably some of you had it read at your weddings, but it's not a romantic, it's appropriate to read it at a wedding, for sure, but it's not about romantic love, as you know. It's in the context of a letter that was written to a church that was torn apart by factions and fightings and failure to love. And so as a church, we've been looking at this letter and for the last few months, and we've come across some of the specific issues that Paul was dealing with, and I made a summary of them for the issues that he was looking at. So if you can put that up on the screen, I'll read them. Criticism of Paul's non-intellectual approach to evangelism. Factions. Some of them were saying, I'm a Paul, I'm a Apollos, well, I'm of Christ. That actually convicted me when Charlie spoke about that a few months ago. Sexual immorality, taking fellow believers to pagan courts, abstaining from eating meat sacrificed to idols and looking down on people who did. Eating meat sacrificed to idols and looking down on people who did not. Irreverent, selfish, and disrespectful behavior in receiving communion. And using the gifts wrongly, not for building others up, but for self-glorification. So Paul lays out these specific issues one by one, and then he zeroes in at the heart of the matter in our chapter that we're looking at this morning, which was the failure to love. And when I backed up and looked at this whole letter and then the chapter that we're dealing with this morning, I saw how clearly it is that love is the ultimate objective of God. And I thought of an analogy that might help us get that. I was brought up on a farm not too far from here, between Vernon and Falkland, and our chief crop was potatoes. And potatoes need a lot of water, so in the hot summers of the Okanagan Valley, it meant that every morning and every evening of every day, except Sunday, because my dad was strict about that, we kids, and there were 10 of us in the family, would have to go up on the fields and we'd have to move these sprinkler pipes. And my sister Janice knows all too well what that meant. So how it worked was we had a river that ran through our farm, and my dad had built this pump that pumped the water from the river into these large main pipes that were strategically located throughout the farm. And then at various intervals along these main pipes, there would be these large hydrants that would turn off and on the water. And then to those hydrants were hooked up our auxiliary pipelines that we had to move. So we had to unhook all the pipes that were in a line and then trudge across these fields of potatoes or alfalfa or whatever it was. But the potatoes especially were really difficult because they were high, they were hilled up and they were high, and we had to step over them. If we didn't, Dad would say, "You're stepping on the potatoes again." So we'd have to step over these potatoes with these long, unwieldy pipes that were slippery and nasty things. And anyway, we would hook them all up again in a line, and then we'd signal to our dad, who was standing at the other end of the field, and he would lean over and turn on the hydrant. And we'd watch to see the water come through the pipes, and the sprinkler heads would start to go slowly, and then a little spurt of water, and then and the water would spray out over the field, the dry part of the field that we had just moved the pipes to. And when I thought of the way Paul puts... As I thought of this, I saw that Paul had done the same kind of thing in this letter. He had laid out the specific issues one by one in a line. And then at the very end of this, the first part of the letter, right up to the 12th chapter, at the very end of the 12th chapter, just before the 13th, the one that we're going to deal with today, he says, "And now I will show you a more excellent way." And as I read this now, I see in my mind's eye my dad, you know, after we've signaled to him, and he leans over and he turns on the water, and a pipe pumps into those pipes, and that water goes everywhere. And so I saw that the reason why we put the pipes there was to get that water from the river onto the fields, as simple as that. And that is what God is doing with us when he works with our lives, lines up all these issues that we have in our churches and in our lives, and then the ultimate goal is to get that love out into the world. And it transforms the landscape around us. It becomes green and productive and fruitful. And so that is what I mean when I say the ultimacy of love, okay? So let's leave that section and go on to the next part. I've got some bad news here and some good news. The bad news is pretty bad, but the good news is really good. So let's look at that second section with all those scary, intimidating words that describe what love is supposed to look like. And it often doesn't in my life. So in one item in particular in this list is love is not self-seeking. That one always convicts me. In my life, I don't know about yours, but in my life, the opposite of love is not hate. I'm just not that dramatic of a person. But the opposite in my life of love is selfishness or self-seeking. That's what can block the flow of love from my life. Self-preoccupation, self-absorption, self-justification, self-admiration. All those hyphenated self words that show up in my life, and maybe I venture to say in yours as well. So let's look at those, if you can put that up, Leighton, that second section of the scripture reading that we looked at this morning. Good, thanks. So if you want to know what selfishness looks like or self-seeking, then you could look at the underside of all those qualities. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm actually going to read out what it looks like to be selfish, okay? So love is patient, and selfishness is impatience, unkindness, envy, boastfulness, pride, dishonoring others, entitlement, anger that easily flares up, getting even, perverse pleasure when you hear something bad about another person, refusal to hear the truth when it doesn't agree with you, attacking other people, and pouncing on their vulnerability, cynicism, pessimism, fickleness. All of these are what selfishness looks like. And I don't know if you can recognize that in your life, but I sure can in mine. Why are we so selfish? Why is it too often our default mode? Well, there's a quote that I read years ago from Oswald Chambers that reads like this: "The root of all sin is the suspicion that God is not good and he doesn't care about what matters most to us." I thought that was so profound. It was Tammy Wilson said something like that a few Sundays ago, and she pointed out that that was the original sin in the Garden of Eden. When the serpent came and began to persuade Adam and Eve that God wasn't good and he didn't care about them, and so they had to act in their own interests, and when they started to believe that, wham, he had them. And he buried his fangs deeply into their hearts, and that those fangs have been in our hearts from the time we were born. This belief that God doesn't care and he's not good, and so I have to look after my own self-interests, and if you're in the way, too bad for you. Get out of my way. Selfishness. Just want to read something that J.I. Packer, a theologian and writer, wrote about this. "The truth is that all human beings are twisted and flawed deep down inside. The human heart is in the grip of a pernicious anti-God allergy, an inner drive towards self-centered self-assertion at all times, an instinct for self-deification, a passion always to be in control so that all our desires get satisfied, and in all relationships we dominate." And lest you think to yourself, "Oh, I'm not really that bad." Here he goes on with more incriminating words. "Our hearts are devious, falsifying, fantasizing, self-deceiving as addicts' hearts are, which means that we ourselves can never be fully realistic about ourselves, never discern our own inner twistedness until God begins to reveal to us what is really wrong with us. Today's world is full of bad news, much of it truly horrific," he says. "But the bad news about human hearts and the consequences facing those whose hearts are not changed is the worst news of all." And so I told you it was bad news, and I've got even more bad news. Because that's on a personal level. But on a societal level, on a broader scale, we have this same self-addiction. And right now, in our contemporary culture, there's a kind of a false cultural narrative that's deeply embedded in our worldview about self. I got all this stuff from Tim Keller, who I found so helpful in this. So I want to acknowledge that. But our Western culture, as you know, is increasingly individualistic, with great emphasis on human rights and freedoms. And of course, Christianity teaches that humans should be free and they should have they should be treated with dignity and respect. In fact, in the pre-Christian world, this was not the case. And many historians and philosophers have, even secular ones, have. There's a general consensus that Christianity, that's a legacy of the teachings of Christ. But because we've drifted away from Christianity, this whole radical and extreme. So much so that one of our highest cultural values is self-expression. And again, Christians want people to express themselves, their unique contribution to society. But this looks a little different. Themes are, and then that becomes you, your identity. You don't get your identity from anywhere else. You get your identity from what you see in yourself, and then you must express that. Nothing should get in the way of a person expressing that, regardless of social norms and expectations. There's a horrible song that we're all so sick of from that movie Frozen that Elsa sings, Let It Go. Okay, so listen to the lyrics on this. Let it go, turn away and slam the door. I don't care what they're going to say. It's time to see what I can do to test the limits and break through. No right, no wrong, no rules for me. I'm free. Let it go, I am one with the wind and sky. Let it go, you'll never see me cry, etc. Okay. Now, to quote Tim Keller on this, the highest purpose of it is to set all individuals free to live as they choose without hindrance, regardless of any commitments to the society, as long as they don't harm someone else's freedom. Choice, he says, becomes the one sacred value, and discrimination the only moral evil. So here in Canada, we have thousands of babies aborted before term because it's the woman's right to choose. We have marriages that dissolve or are not even entered into because one person might hamper another person's self-expression. We have elementary school children who are encouraged to look inside themselves, discover what gender they are, and then express that gender. And then lately, we've had the Supreme Court recommend new legislation to the government about doctor-assisted suicide, that it not only would ensure people access to doctor-assisted death if they're terminally ill, but even if they're suffering mentally, and minors suffering mentally under depression. So you could have a 16-year-old girl who's depressed go to the doctor, and they must either help her die or refer her to another physician who will. Now, fortunately, and thank God that Justin Trudeau and his Liberal government have curtailed some of these more extreme pieces of legislation, but it could be, and many people think it will be, the sort of foot in the door for further legislation like this. It's pretty shocking, but that's the fruit, the logical fruit of where we are. And we agree again that we want to see, the individual freedoms protected. But there are limits and there are boundaries and human responsibilities. And if we ignore that reality, then there is death and destruction in as a result. So can you see the fangs of the serpent at work in our society? Self-addiction on a national scale. Okay, so that is the bad news. But I'm going to tell you what the good news is. The good news is always Jesus. I know it's the Sunday school answer, but it is true. He showed us what love looked like, and he can help free us from our self-addiction. In the weeks leading up to Easter, I put aside my regular Bible reading and started looking at the passion stories in the Gospels. And I was awestruck again and again by the beauty with which this person, Jesus, moved through the last 24 hours of his life. Just the unflinching resolve that he intentionally, because love is intentionally, moved into those terrible hours. He wasn't a passive victim. He had made up his mind that that was what he was going to do, and he met each event with grace and dignity and magnificent restraint. The faithful love that he showed his disciples was another thing that I noticed. These people who were going to be his fledgling leaders of this church, he invested so much hope in them and belief in them. Even though he knew in a matter of hours that they were going to desert him, betray him, deny him, yet he spent time with them and loved them. And in the garden, when the temple guards came to get him, he stepped forward and said, "I am Jesus of Nazareth. Leave these alone. I'm the one you want." So he protected them. Love protects. And then his attentiveness and kindness as he moved through those hours, and when his life intersected with people and how he treated them. There's lots of instances. But I just thought about the thief, for example, the thief on the cross. What did he see in Jesus? Here's this dying, mangled person on a cross next to him. Defeated, humiliated. And this thief saw something and said, "Jesus, when you come into your kingdom, remember me." Imagine, when you come into your kingdom, he does not look like a king at this stage. But there was something about Jesus that was so clear and radiant and majestic. And it was love. It was love. He showed us perfect love. But he went further than that, as we know. He actually took all the consequences of our failures to love, and he took all the suffering that we cause with our foolishness and our selfishness and our cruelties, our wars, our landmines, our unforgiveness. He took all that suffering and absorbed it into himself, and he overcame evil by doing so. On your bulletin insert, I wrote these two little lines by George Herbert, a 16th century poet. "Love is that liquor, sweet and most divine, which my God feels as blood and I as wine." So his... Thanks, Carrie. That's great. Thank you. Oh, there is one here already. I didn't see it. Thank you. So his love, which spilled out of his body as blood and dripped down into the ground, staining that wooden pole he was hanging on. That blood swept away once and for all the lie of the serpent that says God doesn't care, he's not good, and I have to look after myself. So we are now free to entrust our lives to a God who is good and who does care about every detail of our lives. And we're also free to love others as Jesus loved us. So let's look at that part three, becoming love-enabled. When we first come to Jesus, we've been set free from the lie, but there's still some of that residue poison left in our system. We don't love perfectly the minute we become a Christ follower. But as Jesus works with us in his discipleship program for each one of us, he has a unique one for everybody. He works to extract that poison from our system. And the only thing I'm really going to look at in this last section, because we just don't have time, is that first sentence there that says, "Love never fails." That little three-word sentence packs a huge wallop. And we actually sang about it this morning. It was so cool. So that's one of the major themes of the last section anyway. But let's go back and let's say two things about that. First of all, on a personal level, because God's love for us never fails. We can build our lives on it. It's like the rock on which we can build our lives and move forward, like Jesus did, into our world with love and grace. We never have to worry the fact that we don't think he's not good. We know he has every detail of our lives covered, and he shows it to us again and again. In his last prayer in John 17, that great prayer of Jesus, he said, he was talking to his father, and he made this pledge. He said, I have shown you to them, meaning us, and I will continue to show you. I will continue to make you known to them, us, his disciples. That's a promise. And he will do that as we walk through our lives. He will meet us in every situation, in every circumstance. It's just an opportunity for him to show his love and faithfulness to us. In the last, Eugene Peterson paraphrases the last verse of our passage this way: trust steadily in God, hope unswervingly, love extravagantly. And the best of the three is love. When you're frightened and selfish, you can't love extravagantly. But as Jesus works with us, that poison starts to drain out of our belief system, and we are freer and freer to move out into our neighborhoods and into our cities with love. A second point about this love that never fails: it conquers evil. And that's, Duane prayed that, and there are other references to that this morning. Nowhere in Scripture does it ever say evil never fails. It says love never fails. Evil will fail. It does not last. And love overcomes it, and it prevails. And it may take years and a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, but it will happen, that evil cannot stand before love. And just like in our earlier analogy, where the water came through the pipes and the land around it was transformed from Okanagan desert, semi-desert, into lush, green, fruitful, productive land, that's what love will do to our landscape of our culture. Let me just tell you one story, and then we're done. This story I found as an example of this from Daryl Johnson's book on the study of Revelation called Discipleship on the Edge, and it's a great book. Anyway, this story is about a monk by the name of Telemachus. Maybe some of you have heard of him. He lived in the Roman Empire times, and at that point they used to have these gladiator games in the Colosseums. And those gladiator games were all about death, weren't they? Killing each other for sport in front of a cheering, bloodthirsty crowd. Anyway, when Telemachus got to Rome, he made a pilgrimage to Rome. He was from Asia. And they were having a big celebration. And so they had hundreds of these gladiators gathered in the Colosseum. And the whole day was given over to these games. And as the day wore on, there were lots of gladiators that had been killed. And Telemachus, at one point, there was two gladiators that were locked in this life and death struggle, and Telemachus leaped into the arena. He was a big guy. He strode over and wrenched the two gladiators apart, and he said, "Stop this murder. Stop this murder. You should not requite God's mercy," because they had just won this big battle, "by murdering each other." And there was a bit of a silence, and then the audience went wild, and they just started throwing everything they could at this monk, and the gladiators turned and they stabbed him to death. But I just want to read to you what happened then. His work was accomplished at the moment he was struck down, for the shock of such a death before their eyes turned the hearts of the people. They saw the hideous aspects of the favorite vice to which they had blindly surrendered themselves. And from the day Telemachus fell dead in the Colosseum, no other fight of gladiators was ever held there. His act had broken the back of evil. And this has happened through all of our history. In our hearts, first, love overcomes evil. Then in our family relationships, spreading out to our neighborhoods, our churches, and eventually our culture. Love prevails and it overcomes evil. Do you believe it? To sum up our study of 1 Corinthians 13 then, love is the ultimate objective of God. Love was perfectly embodied in Jesus, who set us free from the serpent's lie and is enabling us to love others. God's love never fails, it prevails, and it overcomes evil. Amen.
Pray for us.
Oh, sure.
Just ask Diane to...